Welcome to the CWF Gamecast. I'm Tom Barbalay, and today, once again, I'm joined by my co-host, Jonathan J. Reinhardt. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
It's been too long. I can't remember. The last thing I remember, I was walking through the snow in Reno listening to you talking to the, 12-7 Games fellow.
Yep.
And that seems a long time ago, so I'm not sure. How many weeks has it been? Has it been 4 weeks since we last recorded a podcast together, something like that?
It is something like that. It's funny you mentioned snow, because we're still walking through the snow up here in Massachusetts. We just got some the other day.
Oh, my goodness. The funny thing is I normally laugh at folk like you, but having had the experience of actually trudging through the snow carrying my bags and stuff, I've gained a certain degree of respect of those, let's call them fools that live in the colder part of the US. So, anyway, let's describe what we're going to be talking about this evening. So on your end, you have obviously TotalCon.
Yes.
You spent a weekend there. I got the photographic update. There's a contest update.
Yep.
There's a War at Sea contest update, which I'm assuming is the contest that... Anyway, let me just continue. The blog redesign, Goblins in the Street sales, and our thoughts on episode 47. Which one was that specifically?
That's the interview about 12-7 Games.
Oh, terrific. Okay, I've got thoughts on that, so we'll totally talk about that. And as folks may remember, I have been to the Bay Area, and I actually ended up having to send parcels back to myself. My brother said to me, how come everywhere we seem to be staying, there's always like a game store opposite us? So anyway, more on that later in the show. Also, I have the book that I've been working on for the past year and a half is finally launched, so I can give more details about that. And you're absolutely right, Jonathan, the electronic copies are just going like hotcakes.
I thought so.
Anyway, that I think will be the show this evening. So why don't we get started without any further ado? I was somewhat disappointed that there weren't more photos taken of you at TotalCon, Jonathan.
Yeah, that's the thing about being the person with the camera. Although, I got an iPhone to back up. When it came out on Verizon, I got it on opening day, Valentine's, or whatever it was. And so I had the iPhone. I mean, I could have, you know, used the camera that faces me, took some pictures. But I figured people, you know, who cares about my ugly face? You want to see what's going on at the con.
No, I was just more surprised. I mean, most of the time, and certainly I've got connections in, like, the video games community,
mm-hmm.
and every time there's a convention, this is the nature of Facebook, they will be tagged in other people's photos. So I was fully anticipating a wide variety of photos with you tagged in it. But sadly, no. Maybe they just keep them as private or something. I don't know. But I was looking forward to that.
I hide in the corner, and then I jump out, and I take your picture, and then I jump back in the corner so you can't find
me. Very good. Very good.
But TotalCon was, it was actually really good. It was my first gaming convention to ever go to. I've been to Anime Boston in the past and some work conventions, but I mean, every type of convention's a little different. This one isn't your stereotypical gaming convention from what I understand. I guess most of them, like PAX or EA, like any of those, are Games Day and stuff. They're more focused on either a tournament, but primarily on new products. Come look at our shiny new whatever we want to push out so that you can buy it or whatever. TotalCon's more focused on actually playing games, and not just competitively. They have like all sorts of games, whether it's minis or board games, a lot of role-playing games, and it's just a chance for you to kind of get together and play with people who you wouldn't normally play with. This year they added some new stuff. They added some panels, and that's what I was most interested in. It actually started on, Wednesday of that week. But I went on Friday. Friday night they had a panel, what was it called? Game Designers Panel is the name of it. And it was headed up by this guy. His name is Blitz. He runs the Tri-Tac podcast. It's a gaming podcast, all sorts of stuff. After the panel, he actually recorded an episode of his podcast. But he was the moderator, and they had five people who were in the industry, and they were just kind of talking about what it is to be like a role-playing game designer. It was really interesting for me because, of course, they're talking about being an RPG designer and everything, but it was had like this universal aspect of it so that like it could apply to whether you're just like a writer or like I found stuff that was applicable to what we do here on the podcast and on the blog, but it would work for just about anything, any type of game you did or whatever. They talked about, you know, like you need to stick with it. It's like a 24/7 job, even if you actually have a real job. You still have to put the time in for this every single day. You have to, like, immerse yourself into it. And they all had, like, a real deep passion for it. But what I was really surprised by was the number of people who had stumbled into game design. There's one gentleman, Ben Gerber, who I ended up friending on Facebook after the fact. He runs this website. It's trollitc.com, and it's a gaming blog. It's very popular. And he said it just kind of grew out of him wanting to talk about gaming, and then one day he noticed he was getting 40,000 visits per month on his blog. So then he had always liked to write and decided he was going to try doing some game design. And he puts out these RPG PDF kind of supplements through Drive-Through RPG, I believe it is. And, you know, people find out about them from his blog because he's getting 40,000 visits a month. Well, more than that by now, I'm sure. And they're going and they're buying his product. And he said it's enough for him to pay for, like, a supplement of a board game or whatever. So, like, 30 or 40 bucks every now and again. That he's not getting rich off it. But it's something to do. There's another guy who... It all started from, again, a website. He put a website up talking about gaming, and then he is a computer programmer, actually, I guess, by trade. He ended up working on Warhammer Online. He did a lot of stuff back in the day on the Star Wars role-playing games, and he does a lot with that. There are several other people, common name, they just kind of stumbled in it. One guy stumbled in working with Gary Gygax on the Castle Zagat.
How does one, I mean, obviously it's not possible anymore, but it kind of begs the question how one just, I guess, wanders into an office one day and ends up working with Gary Gygax. I mean, how does that just happen?
Well, for this guy, he did it online, actually. He saw a posting, I believe, in Dragon Magazine, I think it was. And it was like, hey, you know, we want game designers. And he's always wanted to do something with it, but, you know, we just kind of wasn't really sure. And so he said, do you know what? Why not? I'll email a cover letter or whatever. Next day, email Gary Gygax. Loved what he did on the cover letter, said, you know, I want to work with you, and worked with him on this supplement. He's credited in a gaming book with Gary Gygax. I mean, it doesn't get better than that.
No, it doesn't. And obviously no one can do that now. But so let me just get this straight. This was just for RPGs. This wasn't like board games or any other people, game designers. It was just RPG designers.
Yeah, this particular panel was focused on role-playing games. But it really was applicable to anything from miniatures gaming, collectible cards, board games, like anything. I felt there was this core universal aspect. Because if you're going to be a designer of something, chances are you need to have some sort of core rule set within you that would enable you to design whatever it is you're working on. Several of them had mentioned that although they do role-playing games, they don't want to do the rules as if they're a storyteller, which is something I think people would assume would go hand-in-hand with role-playing games because you're role-playing your own story, in essence, that they wanted to focus on removing that aspect so that the players would bring that in and then just make the rules clear-cut so that, you know, if it ever came to a ruling with some sort of game master or whatever, they could say, well, the rule says this, so this is what it is, not let's spend 5 hours discussing what we think the rule means.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's very important, certainly with role-playing games. And actually, really, it's a distinction in a lot of modern role-playing games in contrast to, I guess, role-playing games of 20-odd years ago. I think a lot of this additional narrative stuff seems to be, I mean, actually, it's not in my pile of stuff, but I recently picked up the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles role-playing game on eBay. And that was a role-playing game that I played, I guess, in my 10, 11, 12 years of age, kind of age range, because obviously the Turtles were very popular back then. Mm-hmm. But that is very much, as you say, abstract rule set with the view that the games master and the players. I mean, this is the beauty of role-playing games is actually, as you describe, both the games master and the players actually create the storyline, and what the games themselves traditionally had been was just rules mechanics. Now, I think increasingly, certainly I'm seeing this a lot more. I mean, you play D&D 4, don't you?
Yes.
Do you get the sense that there's a lot more kind of narrative in that, or do you still see it very much as a kind of almost mechanical rule set that the GM and the players need to bring their own rules to, or their own characters to, so to speak?
I think what they decided to do was they decided to take World of Warcraft and then make it into a pen and paper role-playing game.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not sure really how that answers your question, but I think if you were to take the World of Warcraft system and just strip away all the things that make it World of Warcraft, like all the thematic stuff like that, and anything that's proprietary, and you literally translate it into a pen and paper role-playing game, and just remove all that electronic stuff, what you come up with is D&D 4th Ed. And it's it's weird because it has a storytelling aspect, but it's so minimal because they really cut back on the extraneous printing with it. They didn't want to have all this extra words in it. And this is something you and I had talked about before, when ages ago, actually, in relation to your book and the role-playing game that you were working on, and mm-hmm. I think still are working on.
Oh, yeah.
that I had remarked that this, with D&D, it seems like they kind of pared it down and simplified it, that people, nowadays, I feel, gamers don't want all that extra stuff, the extra flavor, which for me is kind of a shame, because I like having the little extra something that makes it stand out, it makes it pop. But D&D for that is definitely more combat-oriented, so you could, you know, role-play a storyline and have non-combat situations, skill challenges and stuff, but that's not really, it doesn't seem like it's a focus. It's more like, you know, you go to location A, and you're going to fight monster 1, 2, and 3, then you go to location B, and you fight monsters 3, 4, and 5, you go to location C, and then you're going to level up, and then you do the same thing again.
You see, that's interesting, because I don't know if I mentioned it, but I purchased the new basic D&D box set probably about 6 months ago now. Mm-hmm. It was only $19. I mean, it just seemed like an insane deal at the time, because it was in a box. And then when I actually opened the box, I realized that it was very, very low material. But it did contain a lot of narrative-related stuff, which I just assumed was also part of the fourth edition, obviously erroneously. And just a little footnote here. You mentioned World of Warcraft, and my understanding is that you're going cold turkey currently. Is that true?
Yeah, I canceled my account today. I have time left on it until May, maybe, but it's been cut. I trimmed the fat.
Is this because you were starting to talk in character? I mean, what was the what was the defining factor? Was it your wife making an ultimatum? I don't know. Let me explain.
It's a combination of not having enough time to play and my lack of enthusiasm for games that make you purchase them and then make you pay to play them.
So anyway, total connoisseur.
So that was the game designers panel, and I can't leave that topic without mentioning the names of the people who are on the panel, because I would feel remiss, especially since one of the panelists has linked to the blog posting I wrote about the panel, and that's also been shared by TotalCon officially, so I don't know that people from who like TotalCon and went there would see the posting and then say, hey, let's go check out this link, and then come across it, but if they happen to be listening, it'd be nice to know that people are getting credit for the work they had done. So the panelists were, let's see, Jay Libby, who actually runs Dilly Green Bean Games, and he's a freelancer. He worked for Wizards and Fantasy Flight. No, I'm sorry, wrong guy. Jay Libby had done, I was misreading my notes there.
He not a problem.
Wrote the Doctor Who Aliens and Creatures book. He's a freelance artist. He wrote a free G.I. Joe RPG. And then he's done a lot of cyberpunk art. So he's a designer, but he's also an artist. It was really neat to get his perspective on stuff because it was kind of unique in that way. Another panelist was Gary Asselford, and he's a freelancer who's worked for Fantasy Flight, and he's the guy who also did Warhammer Online. Right now, I think he works for 38 Studios. And then Jeff Talanian is the gentleman who worked with Gary Gygax. He's doing his own kind of sword and sorcery role-playing game, which is coming out soon. I think he said he was working on it for about 3 years. So for any of you budding game designers out there, that kind of gives you an idea of perhaps how long of a time frame you might need to spend if you want to make any sort of comprehensive role-playing game system. Then there was Ben Gerber, who I had mentioned. He's the owner of Troll in the Corner, which is trollitc.com, and he makes a bunch of PDF rule sets and expansions for the Pathfinder series. And then the last gentleman, his name is James Carpio. He's a co-owner of Chapter 13 Press. He worked on Savage Worlds and wrote for Exile Studios and did a lot of that kind of stuff. So they were the gentlemen who were on the panel, and they were fantastic. I would have gone to the con just to see that panel and nothing else. There was another one on Saturday, which I actually ended up missing. I got there maybe half an hour late, and when I walked into the room, it was dark and no one was in there. So I'm not really sure what was going on, but I've been told that they had very low attendance for the panels, so I'm wondering if they were just no one there or what it was that they decided to cancel or end early or something. Panels, like I said, were my main reason for going, and this was their first year of doing them. It would be nice for them to continue to nurture the panels for next year and to perhaps grow them. They had a lot of podcasters there who were industry people, and I think they could do a whole podcasting section on, you know, like podcast showcase, or maybe have podcasters talk about like how to get into podcasting or what to talk about, or, you know, something relating to that, because they had a lot of experience with that there. And I felt they could have done several panels on it. It would have been very interesting.
So in terms of actual numbers of podcasters, I mean, you mentioned the fellow head of the panel had his own podcast, but were people walking around with audio recorders and things like that? Did you get a sense that the information that was coming from the con was going to go out in multiple podcasts? Were people interviewing each other and these kind of things? I mean, what gave you the sense of the number of podcasters that were there?
Well, that's just, when I say the number of podcasters, I'm just referring to the industry people who are guests at the convention. They handed out a booklet to everyone. It was in your swag bag, and it listed all the guests, and it gave a brief bio. And I think something like between 30 and 50% of them were people who also podcast. So half of the guests that they had there who are involved in the gaming industry are podcasters or, you know, participate in podcasting in some way or form. To me, that seemed like a lot of people.
Yeah, I guess podcasts are really a no-brainer, and I think particularly for anything that is moderately kind of tech nerd related, putting out a podcast just basically gets you in front of a wide variety of people that you probably want to be communicating anyway if you're designing games or even writing science fiction or these kind of things. And it's interesting, actually, surveying podcasts, so particularly science fiction podcasts, there are many that are put out by authors and collections of authors, and I think really it's a no-brainer. But it was good to get a sense that these people were also panelists as well. So you were actually on a panel, weren't you, Jonathan?
No, that would be wonderful. And my wife, she was looking through the booklet that they gave out, and she actually saw the number of podcasters and everything, and she said, you know, Tom and you should come out sometime, and they should invite you guys to be on a panel. And I mean,
damn, Skippy. We show them a thing or two, Jonathan.
I for myself, I feel I have a lot to learn, and, you know, maybe not the best to have on a panel, but it was interesting that she had said that. They had maybe half a dozen panels, I think, there. And like I said, I only went to the Game Designers one, and then I missed one on Saturday, which was gaming in the media. And they actually were supposed to talk a little bit about podcasting and blogging.
Yeah. Was it just because it was early in the morning and people just didn't show up? Was it just a bad time for that particular panel, do you think?
Well, it was in the afternoon, but
One
of my concerns with TotalCon, and I do have a couple. I think it was fantastic. I think they did a really good job. I think the staff was very friendly, very knowledgeable. The people who were playing were well-mannered. I didn't see any evidence of gamers being like a stereotypical gamer, which could be a problem. People seemed to get along. There was a nice variety of game types.
What was the air like? Was there a funk, or was it good breathing weather, so to speak?
Well, there wasn't. I was wondering what that was going to be like, because I know at Anime Boston, I've been told by friends who have served on staff there that they've seen people go and hand out like air fresheners and deodorant and stuff like that, and spray kind of stuff to alleviate the situation. So yeah. I wasn't really sure what it would be like at a dedicated gaming convention. What I think saved it is most of the people who I saw at TotalCon were men and women who were in their 30s and 40s.
Yes.
Some in their 50s, and I would like to think these are people who have, you know, real jobs, who understand what you need to do to take care of yourself, that maybe other people may not have learned, but should learn. So that wasn't a concern. Plus, the venue is actually quite nice. It's a Holiday Inn. I think you said you're going to be going.
Beautiful Mansfield. Yeah, no, I'm not sure whether I'm going to go there now, because there's actually a convention that a lot of people seem to be going to for my other podcasting interest, Model Rail Radio. So my plan was originally to get up to Mansfield in November, and I may still do it, actually, but it sounds like we should probably hit up TotalCon 26, and I probably should be saving my pennies for that kind of trip. Although, let me think, no, we'll be going to the UK next year, but probably later in the year. So many possibilities. I may still come in November, But it doesn't sound like the weather's going to be any better whether I go to beautiful Mansfield in November or beautiful Mansfield in February, by the sounds of things. So, yeah. Not much I can say on that point.
No.
But anyway, so in terms of the stuff that was actually played at TotalCon, I did see some photos of TotalCon where people seem to be playing very detailed kind of dungeon scenarios and various other things. Can you talk a little bit about the games that were played there?
Well, one of the games on Saturday was D&D 4th Ed Dungeon Crawl. And one of the reasons why I'm highlighting this first is that it was run by Derek Lloyd. He's the owner of Battleground Games and Hobbies in Abington and in Plainville. He's a good friend of mine. He's a huge D&D fanatic. He's been playing since D&D has come out. And he did this dungeon crawl. It was actually him and another fellow. They had two games running simultaneous. I think they started at like 10 in the morning and they ran until like the con ended, I believe. So it was like an all-day thing. Are you familiar with D&D Encounters at all?
I think I've seen those books, but tell me more.
D&D Encounters is a thing Wizards of the Coast does where it's like an informal setting where people can kind of come and go. It's played once a week, and you play like an encounter where you go and you fight something, you kill some sort of boss, whatever. And you don't have to come every week. You're not, you don't have that responsibility like you would in a regular D&D game. So that, like, say if you're in an area, say you were up here in Boston, you could play D&D Encounters up here in Boston this week. And then next week, say you were back home, you could play next week back home, and you're not tied to a location. Or you could take a week off, and it wouldn't negatively impact you. You're just there to kind of roll some dice and kill some monsters. The Dungeon Crawl was the same kind of thing, except Derek loves the story, so he blew up the story so that it had more of a role. You were still there, you know, beating the crap out of stuff and killing monsters and rolling dice and everything. But he took, like, D&D Encounters and kind of made it bigger. So he had two of those sessions going on. They were packed for as long as I was there. I think I hung out on Saturday for maybe 2 or 3 hours. And every time I kept on popping into the room, each table was jammed full of people. All the slots were taken. Everyone was having a really good time. And he had tons of his staff there who just kind of come in to check out. And a lot of other gamers were just popping in to see what was going on. So that was really cool. The main gaming room was basically for miniatures gaming and board games. And they had like any number of board games you could think of. A lot of Euro games. I can't remember exact titles. I think I saw Talisman there at some point. They may have had... I think they had some sort of train type games.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there are. Yeah.
I'm not sure if it was like Ticket to Ride or something different. Yeah. Some historical board games. I think I saw Carcassonne at some point. Settlers of Catan, I think, was there. Yeah. Flames of War, they had two tournaments going on.
Gosh. Was it different periods? Was it like early and late or something like that? Was that how they divided it?
One was mid-war, because I think it was a mid-war monsters tournament. Mm-hmm. I could double check. I have a whole posting on our blog about it, but I can't remember off the top of my head. And then okay. The other one was late war, I believe. It looked like a good showing for both of those. The people who were playing had wonderfully painted models. I tried to get some pictures of the camo that they had, and I don't think I did them justice at all. But the tables were fantastic. The models were fantastic. I was surprised by the lack of Warhammer Fantasy and Warhammer 40K because
I was. Now that's very interesting. Anyway, I'll let you continue.
Well, did you in the pictures that I took? Did you see anyone playing 40K?
No. In fact, the thing is that there seems to be, and we kind of discussed this. In fact, I got an email from Henry Hyde, who knows Rick Priestley.
Okay.
In fact, Rick Priestley features in one of the magazines I purchased while I was in the Bay Area. And Henry, I mean, we editorialized actually quite early. We got the scoop with regards to Rick Priestley through some inside emails. But yeah, I think Games Workshop is very interesting times now because and we'll talk a little bit more in my Bay Area update, but the direction that they're taking with regards to fantasy currently is very, very curious and really has rubbed the tournament players the wrong way. I'm, well, friends with and contact with a number of tournament players in both Australia and the UK, and a good majority of them have just completely dropped the system. So their old faithful has left them. And it's really a very curious situation currently. I'm not sure how much with 40K, But certainly with regards to Warhammer Fantasy, it's a very interesting period, and it will really be quite curious to see how Games Workshop weathers through this period. But anyway, I'll let you continue.
Well, I was just going to say that before I went to Totalcon, months and months ago when I was considering whether or not I wanted to go, I talked with people who I game with and asked them if they had been before, what they thought about it, you know, like what I would need to do to prepare for it, just kind of like some background research for it. And I was told by several people that they weren't big fans of Totalcon because whenever they've gone, it has been primarily 40K and fantasy, and they don't play either one of those, the historical gamers, so that they like the historical gaming that was there, and they would go back for that. But the growing, or the surge, I guess you could say, of 40K and fantasy was a little bit off-putting to them. So I was I was expecting to see some 40K and some fantasy, whether it's pickup games, because they had like a pickup game kind of area where you could just go, you could bring whatever games you had and just do like free play, or whether it was like a tournament or, you know, some sort of organized playing going on. Nothing at all. No, I couldn't find any Games Workshop products being played with. You could buy some in the dealer's room, but no one was playing any Games Workshop games as far as I could tell there. And that, I was flabbergasted actually by it. I was just very, very surprised.
Yeah.
I mean, for that matter, there was no War Machine, no Hordes, no 1843, no Confrontation. I didn't see any Malifaux or...
1843 I could understand, because that is really a system that is really, I mean, there's no carryover for that, so I can see that would probably drop off. But Malifaux, I mean, these kind of games are supposed to be the new hot property, so that is really very curious. But it sounds like, I mean, certainly the photos you took seem to indicate that there were lots of kind of miniature-based RPG folk, and I don't think, did you take any photos of the Euro games or any of that kind of stuff?
I think I may have taken one or two, but when I was going around over there, there wasn't a whole lot to snap pictures of. People were either taking breaks or, honestly, the game didn't seem interesting enough to me to warrant my taking the iPhone out and snapping a picture.
One thing
I was really impressed with was a map some people had made, and I wish I knew who they were so I could give them credit, but some people had made for HeroScape. They built this gigantic table out of HeroScape titles. Are you familiar with HeroScape, Tom?
I am. I am back in the day. I am. It's like an old Milton Bradley Games Workshop crossover thing or something like that.
You're thinking of HeroQuest, which was actually Milton Bradley and Games Workshop did that.
Uh-huh.
HeroScape it's an interesting kind of pre-painted miniatures.
Ah, yes, yeah.
Where they give you tiles, and you make your own map out of them. They just kind of slide into each other. They're like different colors, and you can make like mountains or ice or whatever. These people had used the tiles to make, it must have been at least 3 feet tall. Part of it was on the floor. It was a subterranean lava cavern layer kind of thing. And it went all the way up to like a snowy mountaintop. It had planes, and there was, you know, dragons and ghouls and werewolves and minutemen and like all sorts of crazy stuff. But the map was fantastic. They had him spent so much time putting that together, planning it out. And the thing with this is it's all 3D. Everything they give you is, you know, the 3D tiles and stuff. So, like, you could actually take your camera if you wanted and, like, have gone into the map, so to speak, into the board. Mm. And you could have, like, shot, like, a stop-action movie or whatever in there. I just thought it was very well detailed, very well planned out. And I actually thought that the game had died off. I've seen product come out for it now and again, but I've never really heard of anyone playing it recently. So it was interesting for me to see that there was a lot of people playing that. They had a good crowd there.
Very interesting. Okay, so is that a wrap for TotalCon?
Yeah, I think so.
As fans of this show may remember, we took a slight break because my brother, who had never been to the US previously, was doing a 4-city-plus skiing tour, and my responsibility was to look after him while he was in Las Vegas and also the San Francisco Bay Area. And I used to live in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's funny because when I lived there, I never had as much fun as actually when I went there as a tourist or even when I went there on business but just flew in. And this trip was actually really an amazing trip. We got to see a lot of the Bay Area. We started in the Santa Cruz Mountains, went down to Santa Cruz, went up to San Francisco for 3 or 4 days, headed down to Santa Clara, went to Oakland, and then Berkeley, and back to Oakland, and then I went off to Reno, and my brother went down to LA. And as I noted in the intro, it was quite overwhelming to me how many game stores were actually in the Bay Area, but more importantly, how many game stores we actually ended up seeing. I mean, thankfully, my brother, I guess, realized that we could go our separate ways at various points. But I wanted to start with a Games Workshop in the South Bay, because when I was in the Bay Area in July this year, I had anticipated going to at least one game store, and my plan was to go to a Games Workshop in the South Bay. I think it's called Oak Ridge Mall. And I wanted to do that because I don't recall ever actually going to a Games Workshop in the US. And I wanted to see if it was a distinctly different place to my experience as a Games Workshop in the UK. It's been about 6 years since I've walked into a Games Workshop. So having come from Santa Cruz, we drove up and stopped there, and my brother went to a bakery and picked up a bagel or something, and I wandered off to the Games Workshop. And I was actually quite impressed. It's a relatively small Games Workshop. There were the usual kind of flunkies that you expect hanging out there, but the fellow who was heading up the cash register was very friendly. We had a long conversation, and he produced the Orcs and Goblins Codex, which I had a thumb through, and he had some of the new Plastic Savage Orcs assembled. I did really get the sense that it was mainly a hangout for people that were basically talking about various aspects of the rules. There weren't any games being played when I was there, and I was there probably about 11 a.m. I did pick up, and I promised myself I would pick up this while I was in the Bay Area, and I'll reach it out of my pile, Uniforms and Heraldry of the Skaven, which I first actually picked up visually on Blue Table Painting's YouTube channel. And this is interesting as well, because just before I left, I have editorialized the infamous Fidel Castro squat. Just before I left, I purchased 3 Fidel Castro squats from the UK.
Oh,
and here's a thing that I'm planning on doing. My plan is to send one of those to Blue Table Painting, one of those to a painter friend of mine, Fred Reed, who's now in Florida, and a final one to another painter in the US, and basically pay them their top commission rates, like literally the best that they can paint, and see what they come back with. Now, it's a tiny figure. I mean, it's basically, even by dwarf standards, relatively small. But the ability, and I'll give them the ability to do conversions or basing or whatever they want to do, but I'm just interested in seeing each of these painters or painting studios, in the case of Blue Table's, best work. Because I think we were talking about doing a review of miniature painting services somewhere through this year. My other thought was to get a relatively generic unit and send it to each of them and then kind of compare and contrast in terms of the general painting styles. And that may actually work better. I might throw the squat in as a wild card together with like a plastic box set of Skaven or something like that. I mean, something relatively generic just to, or maybe a historical set of figures, maybe a Flames of War tank, a box set of Skaven and a squat to see what they come back with. Because I think there are subtle distinctions, and certainly we would pull no punches here in terms of the analysis. And my background in terms of just boxes of lead painted by... Well, I do have a slight bias, so that's probably why Fred Reed will be an interesting one, because I have a slight bias towards Fred Reed because he did a lot of my painting in the UK, and I do really like his style. He's more a kind of traditional Games Workshop with some elements of modern painting in his style. But I think the potential to do critical and analytical reviews, particularly because these places charge a reasonable amount per figure. But anyway, this is a complete digression. So where was I? Skaven, okay. Got the squats and also got the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle role-playing game when I got back. But anyway, so where did I go next? So we went up to San Francisco, and I think I actually missed... I don't think I did anything wargaming-related in San Francisco, but then went to Oakland, and in Oakland our hotel was directly... Oh, no, we went to San Rafael, that's right, and I went to Gamescape North in San Rafael. Now, San Rafael's a very interesting town. I'd been there previously, and I remember perhaps walking through the front of the Gamescape previously with a friend when I lived in the Bay Area. They have an amazing... I mean, basically, I've not been to New England game stores, but game stores in the Bay Area are just really, really phenomenal in terms of just size, the quality of service. I went in there looking for the Berger Panther, which I've talked about in the past in terms of the kind of, you know, omnipresent recovery vehicle. And they went through everything. We ended up on Wikipedia and actually established the only way to actually purchase this Flames of War figure was through Peter Pick. And I think our correspondent, Ketchikan Leaf One, whose name is Martin, sent me a link, actually, to exactly the miniature. So you can't get them through the traditional Flames of War range. You need to go to a third-party miniature manufacturer in order to get that. But they just had a phenomenal range. They had a good selection of Flames of War. They had a substantial selection of a variety of different role-playing games, good selection of, obviously, the GW product, and also some interesting Malifaux and some interesting other smaller, like, miniature manufacturers and just lots of magazines and things like that. And that was a phenomenal store. I don't think I purchased anything there, but I was actually looking for a couple of things specifically. So we moved on to Oakland, and in Oakland, across the street from us was, I want to say, Endgame. And that was another phenomenal store, slightly smaller than Gamescape North. But the quality of stuff that was there was just phenomenal. And they had a variety of, like, 80s RPGs, and they basically had a back section which was just bookshelves and bookshelves and bookshelves of just classic role-playing games from the 80s and 90s. And that was just phenomenal. I spent probably about an hour and a half there just, you know, looking around and getting a sense of what they had. The interesting thing that they had was a series of Games Workshop art books that I'd never seen anywhere else. I'd seen a small selection. That's not true. I'd seen a small selection in the Games Workshop in Oak Ridge. But they had a wide variety of art books that I'd never actually seen previously associated with Games Workshop. I did purchase some stuff there, and I first picked up, and you can hear by probably the rustling of paper how much stuff I've purchased in the Bay Area. I first picked up Earth and Steel, which is the new German Flames of War from June to September 1944 rule set. I'd heard the review on our sister podcast, What Would Patton Do? And I thought, I've got to pick this thing up. I spent about a day with this book, and then I had to send it back to myself. And honestly, I haven't been through it since. I spent an evening flipping through it, and then I just decided I had to send it back to myself just to minimize my bag weight, particularly as I had to carry the bag through the snow later on in the trip. But yeah, that is something that I'm certainly going to be thumbing through, and in particular because I have a, well, possibly to be expanded, Panzer Regiment in, could go in a wide variety of different directions. I wanted to get the absolute up-to-the-minute latest rule set associated with Germans, so picked that up. I also picked up an older copy of War Games Illustrated and Miniature Wargaming. And Miniature Wargaming, it's the January 2011 issue, had an interview with Rick Priestley. And for folks who may be familiar, we, prior even to the news, started speculating, I think in October last year, that Rick Priestley was getting fed up with Games Workshop, heading out, and basically a wide variety of things were going to go on. This was very much an interview, non-interview. It really didn't say a lot about the actual underlying reasons that Rick Priestley left. In fact, he made allusions to the fact that he was working on something and then not working on something and that something would come out in his absence. But really, it was quite a confused interview, and I got the sense that it was probably taken very soon after he left Games Workshop and where he was still considering his words, so to speak. So not really the tell-all that was described on the cover, and certainly I know Henry Hart listens to this podcast. I think, Henry, if you could get the scoop, if you could get the warts and all, if you could get sued by Games Workshop through the quality of your interview with Rick Priestley, that would be one to go for. Oh, while I mention our friend Henry Hyde, I picked up, before I left, Ancient Warfare that I found in a Barnes & Noble. And Ancient Warfare is basically talks about ancient warfare, funnily enough, and not really role-playing game related, but obviously there are, particularly for historical wargamers, there are lots of ebbs and flows, and there is an ad for battle games. In fact, it seems to be quite interconnected in terms of publication-wise, and it does advertise miniatures through some parts of it. But I thought that was generally very good. There's another one that's coming out called, I think, Medieval Warfare, and I would even consider a subscription to that, because certainly, well, I'm more interested in medieval warfare than Alien Nations. But moving right along, we then ended up in Berkeley. And I don't even know how one describes Berkeley, apart from saying that if you are a bibliophile and if you're afflicted by the inability to control yourself when you are surrounded by lots and lots and lots of old books, you should never go to Berkeley. Because thankfully, my brother was sufficiently impatient and called me at regular intervals, so I was only able to go into two secondhand bookstores. But I picked up a wide variety of historical books. I've discovered through our local secondhand bookstores the Ballantine's Illustrated History of World War II. And these are books that come from, I think, the 1950s, 1969. I think some of them are earlier. Let me just see. I think I have one on armour that's earlier than this. No, 1970. Let me see. Yeah, they're of that kind of time frame. Very much 68. Very much kind of no-holds-barred war histories written probably by people that have a very intimate connection with it. I picked up five of these. Barbarossa, Tank Forces of Allied Armour in World War II, Africa Corps, the Nuremberg Rallies, and Commando. And out of these, I think the Africa Corps one was the best, possibly Barbarossa. But yeah, very, very good, old, musty books, lots of information in a relatively small space. Then I stumbled upon Games of Berkeley. It's hard to describe in context of these other game stores that I've described Games of Berkeley, except to say that Games of Berkeley probably has the highest density of, well, kind of eclectic Games Workshop-related stuff. We've talked previously about the Citadel Journals and my unhealthy relationship with the Citadel Journals. They had Fanatic magazine. I purchased three Fanatic magazines, which I think in some regard were a kind of continuation of the Citadel Journals for a very short period of time. So I picked up three issues of that. And also some Warhammer Monthly comics, which I don't think have been around for a while. Again, picked up three issues of that, and that was pretty well my purchasing history. It doesn't seem like a lot now I talk about it. I mean, I did purchase some other books and some other bits and pieces that I sent back to myself, including, obviously, presents for my wife, too, as being a married man. Yeah, I think certainly out of the places that I went to, I like Berkeley in terms of... Well, it was interesting, actually. Both the Oakland and the Berkeley stores that I went into had a group of probably 40-something men discussing various gaming systems very passionately. And in fact, in the case of Oakland, in the case of Endgames, I would have paid for and left the game store a lot sooner, except the fact that the whole kind of cash register area was just like a swarm of 40-somethings, and I really couldn't get close to the cash register. So I kind of kept browsing with the view that my brother was sleeping back at the hotel, and I thought, I got time to kill. The interesting thing about that store in particular is one of the store owners is a Gold Demon painting winner.
Ooh.
They have various kind of glass figure cases filled with just amazing looking... They had like an Imperial Guard army that was themed on the First World War beautifully. So they had all the tanks converted to be like First World War tanks, but like a bit more kind of strange and bulbous. And there were a variety of other different conversions. I think there was like an Orcs and Goblins army that had like a series of really bizarre conversions. But I was mainly captivated by the First World War Imperial Guard. And I seem to remember there was a strange Space Marines army, and there were some like other things. But really, it was just... The main thing that caught me was, firstly, the Gold Demons actually in the figure cases as well. And also just the sense that, yeah, this was a store. All the stores were really heavily established. And here in Vegas, really the game stores we have here, you don't get the sense that they're fly-by-night, but you get the sense that they only opened probably in the past 2-3 years and will probably close again in the next 2-3 years. And these were all established stores. So that was my trip to the Bay Area. Pretty good in terms of just general restraint. I took my iPhone and made various notes of things that I may purchase in the future. But I think just the quality of game stores there was just kind of overwhelming to me, because there's nothing really like that here. And I would probably play more games and hang out with more of these folk and if there was a quality of game store here. But also the locations, I think, were ideally suited. All the game stores were kind of centrally located, relatively easy to get to. And, you know, I get the impression that if you get off a train in Berkeley and literally, you know, Games of Berkeley is right there, similarly Oakland, similarly, you know, these kind of central locations, easy to access. I don't know. It made me realize, as I mentioned, I work with a couple of gamers, and I mentioned it to one of them, and he said, yes, we really are in the desert, both metaphorically, gaming-wise, and physically. But yeah, it was a really nice experience. And for folks who are listening in the Bay Area, yeah, I will be looking to move there in the near future if I want to continue these kind of pursuits. It was really quite a nice converting experience. And yeah, I think there's a lot going on in that part of the world. So anyway, that's my trip to the Bay Area. Do you have any questions, Jonathan? I seem to have just been doing a monologue for a...
Well, no, I was listening, and it sounds like you had a fantastic time. It's I think part of it is that the Bay Area is a unique place, and so this convergence of everything has enabled there to be this outpouring of, you know, great bookstores and gaming stores. I think it's kind of like an eclectic location where people have a combination of good education levels, financial situation, and interests, that it's kind of all plays together and helps it to nurture and to grow. So I was glad you were able to go out there and participate in that as a tourist, because like you said, you appreciate it more than if you're living there all the time. You see the same place, you walk by it 5 times, you know, a day, and you think nothing of it. But if you come back and you're visiting, you're like, wow, I never noticed that. It was actually really interesting, and I should go there.
So, Jonathan, I understand that you've been launching contests left, right, and center, and we need to do some recaps associated with these things. What's the story currently?
Well, we finished up our previous contest, which was the Name Our Podcast contest. And so we got a wonderful submission, and we're renaming the podcast as Monty and the Fox's Wargaming Show. That will, of course, be happening as soon as we take care of the RSS feed issues and get everything else into place, or the new logo and the new design and everything and all that kind of stuff. But that's coming, so I don't want people to think that we forgot about that or that we're not doing anything with it. We are just, it's taking a little longer, but that'll be coming out. So since that contest had ended, another one kind of popped up spontaneously, I guess. It came out of the recording I did with Bill Detmers of 127games.com, which was over episode 47, I guess, which... That was our last episode, I think.
Yes.
Anyway, Bill had been talking about something that troubles him, I guess. What he was saying is that with the game War at Sea, a lot of the stuff is out of print. And it's very difficult because of that for people who just get into the game. In particular, younger gamers, people in their teens, early 20s, but basically teenagers and preteens who are interested in the game and interested in playing, that they can't get the pieces that they would need or want because they're out of print. And to get them on the secondary market is very expensive. One of the pieces, it's from the first set, is a German plane, the Condor. And I think I've seen that go online on eBay for $50. There's another one, also from the first set, another plane. It's for the Americans. It's a PBY Catalina that routinely goes for between $20 and $35. Who has 35 bucks to spend on a single piece of plastic? Not many people, and those who do probably already have it or don't need to have another one. So Bill was trying to figure out a way to be able to help these younger gamers get some of these pieces that they couldn't normally get, but without spending any money on it. Because, of course, I mean, the easiest thing would be for them to spend the money, but either they don't have it or it's just so expensive to get these pieces that if they have their allowance or, you know, if they're working at a job part-time or whatever, if they have, like, 50 bucks saved up, they're going to blow it all in one model. And that's not any way to really make a fighting force. So he wanted to come up with something where they could, you know, do what he calls sweat equity and do something else as payment so that they could work up some sort of system or do something. He mentioned, like, research for, like, flavor text or cards or, you know, to help people out who are looking into World War II kind of stuff or whatever. But he didn't have any really good solution, and he wanted to try to tie it in with the Axis and Allies Foro Mini, which is the most robust Axis and Allies miniatures and War at Sea naval miniatures community anywhere I've seen online. They have tons and tons of people who are involved. They have a direct line to Richard Baker, who is the designer from Wizards of the Coast for War at Sea. And they're a group of wonderful people. They do a lot of good work. So he wanted to try to kind of tie it in there. And as he was talking about it, I thought, well, you know, why don't we do a contest, and we'll get submissions from people, and we'll give prizes. You know, we'll pick whatever one we think is the best submission and give that person a prize. And if more than one person has submissions that we think are fantastic, that would be a good solution to this, then maybe there'll be more than one prize. So Bill had said that to help us out, he's going to throw in a booster of Wurtzy, I believe it is. I believe whoever wins will get to pick a booster, probably from a list of what's set. And I threw in some stuff already, but I'm throwing in something from the convention. I'm throwing in a PDF download of The World of Erroneous Contagion Infected Zombies. This is for the Pathfinder system. It's put out by Kroll in the Corner. This was actually part of the prize package, or swag bag, from that all the people who went to the TotalCon got. So I had downloaded it, and I have it ready to go into the prize package. And, you know, there'll be other stuff going into the prize package for whoever wins. We've gotten one submission so far. I gotta say, I think it's a really good one, so I think they've set the bar very high. But I think that other people, other listeners, people who go on the blog, that all of you, I think you're skilled enough, capable enough that you can do better. So I just want to entreat you to give us your submissions and toss your hat into the ring and see what's going on. The contest is still happening. Just, you know, we want some more submissions before we pick a winner. And you'll get some good prizes, and we can help out some kids, which would be really good. Bill said that whatever is done, we can work it so that the kids will get the units that they need from his collection, that he'll work it out so that whatever the system is, that it'll end up working out, and he'll just, that'll be the payment instead of giving him money. He has plenty of the stuff, tons and tons and tons of it. For those of you who listened to that episode, he describes the warehouse, in essence, that he has in his home, and all the gaming product he has. He has boxes and boxes of it. So he's happy to do it and happy to help out, and I'm happy to get the message out. So we have information on that. It'll be in the show notes for this episode, but it was also in the show notes for episode 47, I think it was. Hope people can do that, and we'll keep on adding to the prize package and see what we can do.
And if I could make a personal appeal, because I know there are some accent fetishists out there at the What Would Patton Do podcast, and I know they're always thinking about the kids, particularly after their recent T-shirts, that maybe I should up the ante and just say that if the What Would Patton Do podcast would be willing to also come up with similar ideas, that I would be willing to appear on one of their shows and do the one and only Tom Barbalay's accent live for them, answer questions, do stand-up, do a wide variety of the things that you get for absolutely nothing here, Jonathan, but they seem to want on their podcast. And, if they can come up with something, obviously giving the prize back to another podcast is kind of a bit cheesy, but if any of them can think of an idea associated with this contest, I'd be more than happy to do appearances, book signings, bar mitzvahs, etc. on their behalf too. So as we seem to be upping the ante continuously with these group of individuals in Virginia, I'd like to put that out there. What Would Patton Do podcast, the ante is raised.
Well, Stephen, Tom's thrown the gauntlet down, so it's in your court now. Let's see what you do.
Very good, very good. So I understand that you've redesigned the blog recently, or you're in the process of redesigning the blog.
Yeah, I'm always redesigning the blog. At least that's how I feel. I redesigned it actually not too long ago to do what I call my version of the Apple aesthetic. And then for a while I had been wanting to change it, because as much as I liked it before, you know, it was clean and crisp with a white background and everything, it kind of seemed, I don't know, not professional, I guess. A little too casual. And so I wanted to come up with something that would focus more on the fact that what we do is more formalized, and that we're talking, hopefully objectively, about games and gaming, and for it to be a little more informational. So I had looked around for, you know, themes out there for WordPress, which is the blogging setup that we use. You know, some themes that would fit this, like a magazine or newspaper type thing that would be kind of friendly. And I came across one called Mimbo. They have a paid version of it, which, of course, I don't want to do because, you know, we're not some big money outfit out there. And to buy some of these featured themes that are, you know, cost money, they're pretty expensive. Anywhere from $50 on up to $150 for some of the stuff. And I don't know, for me, that's a little ridiculous.
Yeah.
So they had a free version of it, which I played with, and I'm still tweaking it. But I instituted it, and I think it makes things a little cleaner. I think it makes things a little easier to use. I'm still trying to figure out how to do some stuff, like add pictures to the front page so that you see the list of the articles. And, you know, I routinely will insert images into the blog postings because, you know, words are words, but a picture tells 1,000 words. So, and plus people like to look at images, and I'm a very visual person, and I think there's a lot of other people who are visual as well. So as much as it is good to see the words, it's nice to see a picture of what you're talking about. I just haven't figured that out yet. But what I really like is that it makes it very easy to have this hierarchy. So it starts off with our pages. And right there we have like the podcast at the top, we have the Editor's Choice Award and all that kind of stuff. And then next down it says like what our title of the blog is and what we do. And then it has a search bar. So I mean, you don't have to go very far, you can just type in whatever you want. And it searches all of the content on the blog. And there's tons of content on there. So it can be kind of hard to find what you need. But then everything's just really easy to move around with widgets. They're, you know, like easily updatable content. You just kind of drag and drop, so to speak. So, like, it's all there. If you have an account on the blog, which all user accounts are free, and they make it easier for you to submit comments and all that kind of stuff, you can log in. And then it shows, like, featured content is what it's called. So just kind of stuff that I pick out, things that I think are important. We have, like, a featured category. But then I have, like, our announcements up there and contests and the podcast. And then it highlights all, like, the most recent stuff. So it makes the newest posts the biggest and the ones that are older a little bit smaller, but still pretty big. It has all the stuff that we had before, you know, our sponsors. It has links to all our friends and our Facebook page and all that and recent comments and our Twitter feed and everything. But things have just been moved around a little bit. It's all accessible. The RSS feed's still near the top. Hopefully everything's working. I haven't found any broken things, but if listeners are visiting our blog and going to the show notes and they're finding something that's not working, please let us know. I try to test things before I implement them, but something always ends up flying under the radar, and then I end up having to fix it afterwards. And I'm not a computer programmer. I'm not a math science person. I'm an English history kind of guy, so... this is not my forte, so it takes me a while to get through it, but I thought it was time to, you know, redo stuff, especially with spring coming, and do a little spring cleaning.
So, I understand Goblinson in the Streets, our first review copy has sparked sales or something like that, or have they reduced the price? Well, what's the news with Goblins in the Streets?
Well, they're doing this 25% off sale for a limited time only, and they gave a reason why on their Facebook page, which... I'm trying to remember what it was. It was in celebration of something. Game Master Day, which I think is March 4th? March 4th, I think. So to celebrate Game Master Day, they wanted to do something for game masters and for role players everywhere. And so they've taken 25% off of Goblins in the Street. For those of you who may not know, it's a PDF download from via drivethroughrpg.com. It's put out by Imperium Star Games. They're a local startup gaming company here in Massachusetts. It's for D&D, 4th Ed, but you can adapt it to just about any system. We did a review on it on the blog and on the podcast, and it's pretty interesting. I just thought it was interesting that they're doing a discount on this, especially since I'm not sure how familiar people are with Groupon, which is something I've kind of gotten into lately. I've been fascinated by it.
Yeah.
But a local game store had a Groupon recently where you paid X amount and then you got double the amount of the gift certificate, so to speak, and value at the store. I think it was The Wiz. So the week that came out, which was, I guess, end of last week, they did that. And then at TotalCon, Battleground Games and Hobbies, was given 25% off for anyone who played in their event, any of their events that day. And then here's Imperium Star Games doing 25% off Goblins in the Streets. I'm not sure why Imperium Star Games is given the discount if, you know, it's... Obviously because they want to celebrate GM Day, but I don't know if like sales have been really good or what it is. I know sales were a little slow at first, and they were very appreciative of our reviews. So I'm hoping, you know, we helped. We didn't review it to help, we reviewed it because it was interesting, but hopefully that helped. And hopefully the sales will give them some more, you know, purchases with it. It's very interesting that we've been using it as price support, so that's always a thought.
Yeah, yeah. I think certainly I'm interested in what they do next. I'm interested in the directions that they take it, and I think Goblins in the Streets was an interesting test case, and maybe they'll take our review to heart. Maybe they'll put in a bit more material next time. Spell checking, who knows? But I'm interested in seeing what they do next, actually.
Well, I know they are working on the next side quest. They don't have the title yet or details, but I know they started on it. And then I also heard that they are going to, quote, expand the past side quests. What they mean by that, I don't know. But to me, I think maybe they did take at least part of our review to heart and, you know, might be adding more content to it. And what they add, I'm not really sure how that's going to play for people who already purchased it. So I don't know if they, say if they add a whole new section to Goblins in the Streets, for example, and say Joe Schmo bought a copy of the old one. I don't know if they get access to the new one or if they have to pay. I'm not sure how any of that is.
This idea of expansion, though, I mean, I remember back in the day, I think it was Vault of the Drow, one of the old D&D modules. They released an expansion to that module, and it was literally just an additional booklet, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So there are probably ways that they can do it where it could be purchased separately, where the two things are divided. I think they called it, like, Vault of the Drow was something, you know, module, you know, 32 or whatever, and then they produced what they called module 32B, which I don't think would have made much sense if you didn't own Vault of the Drow, but certainly it meant, I don't know if they did it with future purchases or whether they were always two separate things, but the expansion was sold separately. But I think that model could be possible as well, where, you know, if it's, I don't know how much they'd sell it for together, but maybe, like, you know, 99 cents or some really discount purchase associated with getting the additional expansion content, I'm sure. You know, I'm sure they have better numbers and better ideas, but, I mean, there are ways that they could get out the expansion content both built into the existing stuff and also separate from it for people that wanted to pick it up.
Yeah, I don't know, like, if they're just adding more into Goblins in the Streets, or if they're doing, like, say, Goblins in the Streets 2, continuing the Goblins in the Streets story, or I'm not really sure how they're doing it, because what I heard, the wording was vague enough that I think you could interpret it a bunch of different ways, but whatever they mean, they're expanding however they choose to define that, but they're going to expand their previous side quests. And they've done two, and they're working on a third one. I like to think that means things are going at least relatively well for them. So I'm not quite sure, but I just thought it was interesting that they have it at a 25% off. So if anyone was tentative about getting it before, I mean, we gave a good review, not a great review, but a good review. It did have some areas of improvement, but I mean, 25% off, and it was already like $250, so I mean, it's not pricey to begin with, but 25% off, maybe it'll get someone to buy it who was on the fence.
Yeah, yeah. So, returning to episode 47, I thought it was a really good interview with Bill Detmers. I was a bit worried coming into it that it was just going to be like a plug fest. You know, this guy's obviously the sponsor of the show. And I thought there were a number of ways that it could have gone really wrong. And nothing, I mean, what came out of the interview was just that, you know, Bill Detmers is obviously a really nice guy, obviously has a clear vision with regards to 12/7, and particularly the idea of the contest I really like in terms of getting kids, thinking about different ways that they can actually earn miniatures through, I guess, Bill's challenge. So I really enjoyed it. I listened to it both whilst trudging through the snow and also whilst waiting at Reno Airport for a flight that never came and kind of extended on. And funnily enough, in those kind of frustrating times, the calming voice of Jonathan J. Reinhardt and co. Was exactly what was called for. But yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed the interview, and I'd like to get Bill back on. I'd like to have him on periodically, not just to give 12/7 Games updates, but also to talk. I mean, the thing that I like most about the show was actually his discussion associated with his Epic Games. And I think, you know, that kind of insight would always be welcome, and I'd like to have Bill back on in the future to talk about that specifically.
I think he'd love to be on, and I agree with you. When I was preparing for the interview, of course I wanted to, you know, let people know that they can go to 12/7 Games, or not that I would let them know, that Bill would let them know that they can go and they can shop there and everything. But especially because his company is one of our sponsors, I didn't want to be like, hey, 127 Games is great, you must go here, and basically find different ways of saying that throughout the episode, because I attend a lot of webinars for work, and they're sponsored by, you know, all these different companies, and at the start of every webinar, there's like 5 or 10 minutes where they find a bunch of different ways to say, company A is wonderful, company B is great, you should buy stuff from company C, and it's my least favorite part of the webinar, so I'm sure people tune out mentally from that kind of stuff, and I just think it's uninteresting. But I thought that Bill would be fantastic to tell his story, because it's so unique to me that he made the jump from just being a collector to turning it into a business. But then also, I've been hearing for quite a while about the immense fun people have playing War at Sea with him, and so just having him recount a game, I thought would be interesting. Of course, he has a unique situation with the game he talked about, where he was able to field so many of the Georges, because, I mean, as he said, no one else in the world probably has as many of them as he does. And, like, not in his business collection, in his personal collection, just because he bought all of them in the beginning. I mean, who else is going to do that? Not many. So something like that would be unexpected. But he's really passionate about it, and I think being able to find someone who is as passionate about anything is a rarity. And he just does a good job, and I think he gets an eclectic group of people to play. So it was just kind of cool for me to hear that. And I think he would enjoy talking about his games in the future, do, you know, like some sort of battle report, I guess, every now and again of, you know, what he's played in the past few months or whatever. I don't think he gets to play very often, but when he does get to play, I think they do it big.
Certainly, certainly. And I understand that you had some additional thoughts on the Pandemic board game.
Well, I went out, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, with a friend from work, and his entire family are big Eurogamers. They don't get to see each other very often, usually at the holidays, but whenever they get together, they play, like, Agricola and, like, all these different Euro games, and they'll play for hours and hours and hours. And he had heard about Pandemic, but he had never played it. So we went out, you know, for drinks or whatever after work, and then we actually ended up at the Wiz in Westboro, and we played Pandemic, and it was his first time, and it was my, I guess, third or fourth. It was only the two of us, which was the downside, but I thought it was interesting that in this game, it was the furthest we had ever gotten in being able to try to beat the game. We still lost, which I think there's something peculiar about the fact that there's a game that it's almost impossible to win at. When that stops being a game and starts becoming something else, I'm not really sure. But we got to a certain point where it looked like we would, you know, win, and then we lost because we ran out of cards to draw is what it was. And that's one of the ways in which you lose the game. But, like, things, it didn't take long to play. We got in a whole game in less than an hour. And that included, you know, explaining the rules, which I needed a refresher course, and then figuring things out and plotting strategy. But with this particular game, I was really interested in that the cooperative aspect really blossomed, because my friend, he's a very reasoned thinker. So he was able to really plot what he needed to do, and he got a very quick grasp at it. And then we worked together to plot, you know, like what I needed to do and what he needed to do. And like how a chess player would figure out things like 2 or 3 moves down the road. We were like, if we do this, then we will do that and that. So it really highlighted for me that you can play it like on a more casual level and just do whatever, and you could win. The times I have played like that, we have not. But that if you actually take your time to sit and think about it for a moment, that it has this extra depth to it, which consequently has a direct relationship to, or at least I think it does, to your chances of winning. We had one disease left to try to strike down, and we would have done it if we hadn't run out of cards. We were a turn or 2 turns away from doing it. But it was just a different play style, and it's just interesting to see how you can play a game like this, and you can play with, you know, different people and see how their playing styles impact it, because it really is all of you versus the game. It's not like your playing style doesn't matter because it's, you know, me versus the game and you versus the game separately and the game versus each of us and you versus me or whatever. Like, how you work together was really good. And I could actually, based on the game that we played, I could see this game actually being used by companies for team building. You know, Microsoft or wherever, like where I work, I could see it being used at like a company meeting or whatever as like a team building exercise to get people to talk and open up avenues and stuff. So it made me think more about how you could do that sort of stuff and use games in maybe non-traditional venues. So just, I think I have a lot more to learn from Pandemic, but I think it has a lot more to teach for all of us. So it's just very interesting for me on how engaged it has made me. I don't think I've been this engaged in a board game in quite a while.
Hmm. That's an interesting review. How many is the maximum number of players you've played with so far?
I played with, I want to say 4. And I think the max is either 5 or 6.
Right. And how did the game, I mean, I think we talked about this last time, but my understanding is that the game, if you have a kind of group strategy, the game is easier to beat the more players you have involved.
Yeah, I think so, because each player has like a unique capability, and your capability allows you to, your unique role gives you certain skills that you can use. So the skills kind of come together like a jigsaw puzzle, and then, you know, the part isn't as strong as the whole, so to speak. So if you only have 2 people playing, you only have 2 of those pieces, and then you have all these gaps like Swiss cheese around you, which kind of hold you down. It's doable, as it was almost shown in the game I played last time with my friend. But in the previous games, we didn't do anywhere near as well until we had 4 players. And, I mean, we still lost. We were maybe half a dozen turns away from winning that time. I think we could have won if we had, you know, been used to it more often. Or if we did something different, I think we could have won. But it was just interesting that you really do, I think, need a combination of more people, and then you need to just kind of sit and think about it for a little bit before you actually do stuff.
Very interesting, very interesting. Well, for folks who recall when I first joined this podcast, what, about 3 or 4 months ago now, I was working on the final throes associated with my book, Field of Chaos, and I don't know, it's been a long, strange trip to actually get this thing out, but I got back from the Bay Area, and when I was in the Bay Area, I had final proof copies sent to my friend Bruce Damer, who I stayed with initially with my brother in Santa Cruz, and my anticipation was to give copies to people along my trip, which I did. But reading through it, I realized that this was actually probably going to be the release version, and I thought, well, why not, you know, why waste any more time with regards to final, you know, final tweaking? So I got back and started the release process through Lulu.com, and it's now available in this strange kind of, it's been proved, so it's going to be the version that will hit stores in about 5 weeks' time, but it's not yet in stores. And for that reason, I can offer it at a considerable discount. I think it's 30% on the electronic book form, which is like $3.99, and then something similar on the paper book form, which is under $10, which was my initial requirement. And the electronic book version has just been, one can't really use the metaphor flying off the shelves, but it's been considerably more popular, and I think particularly because the folks who learned about it early on, there was a large kind of international group. But it's like at about a 7-to-1 ratio currently between electronic book and paper. And a large part of that as well is that I think people just don't want to wait anymore. There's some kind of immediate gratification of immediately having the electronic version. This seems to be the phenomenon that I'm seeing. And within about 6 hours of me formally launching it, I was already contacted by a woman who had read it. Well, I don't want to use the term cover to cover, but had read the electronic version to the end and was already asking me questions about the sequel, which was really quite curious.
Is there a sequel? But,
yeah, there is. There are 3. It's part of a 3 series, potentially a 4th one. And I have the second one in a... to give some background to it, and as this is a leisurely podcast, I have the format to give some background to it. I wrote this book from 1992 through to 1993, but I actually wrote 5 versions of it, plus an additional version. And the version that is published is like the 4th version, plus this additional account of me going to like this strange jungle camp. Camp is really the wrong term. Strange jungle environment. And so the role-playing game aspect of it is really an interpolation of the kind of dark, cyberpunk-esque, like it's about, you know, viruses infecting government computers and all this kind of stuff, with, in parallel to this, this almost kind of, I don't know, anti-establishment, almost terrorist-style training camp bit to it as well. So there's an interesting kind of, firstly, prehistory, because it's based in the early 90s. I filmed a video, actually, for the podcast on the Palladium Books weapons, modern weapons or something. And that actually was published in 1995, I want to say, or 1993 maybe even. And anyway, so that tells me exactly what weapons were up until that point. So the role-playing game takes a wide variety of the kind of cyberpunk hacking prehistory kind of stuff, plus the jungle training camps and all this kind of stuff, and creates quite an interesting role-playing game based on these themes. But for folks who listen to this podcast and are interested in getting their reduced-rate copy, Field of Chaos, all one word, field as in playing field, of as in of, and chaos as in chaos, .com. There's a Facebook-like thing that I have set up as well. But in terms of the actual sales, all the money that I'm making through this, I'm reintegrating into things like Facebook ads and a wide variety of other things, because my view is not to make money from this, but just to maximize the number of people that actually get to read it. And I think what I'm interested in doing through using Lulu and really pushing down the price as much as possible on everything is to get a circumstance where this new medium is picked up. I mean, very similar to what I've been doing podcasts for about 5 years now, I really want a way of having a number like, you know, 1,000 sales or 2,000 sales or these kind of things. So I'm trying to recirculate all the money back into actually promoting it with the view that I want to get the sales numbers up as reasonable as possible. And the role-playing game is something that I'm working on with the view that there's a lot of mythology in this writing. It's kind of difficult to describe if you haven't actually read it, but there's a lot of underlying mythology, and the fourth version that is the one that was published had a lot of mythology that I put together very quickly, but has a lot of kind of deeper mythology, particularly like language and some understanding of what was, I guess, the very early internet as this kind of, you know, very cyberpunk-esque in terms of this kind of almost mythological forum that people enter into. So there are all these kind of elements that come through the role-playing game more so, but the book really provides an introduction to all of that. And as a process, it's been really fun. I've really enjoyed the whole publishing online phenomena so far. It has been somewhat introverted because I've been working on, well, like I wrote the text, what, 17, 18 years ago now, and I've been reworking aspects and lots of kind of typographical errors and sense checking and all this kind of stuff, pulling together in what has finally been produced. But as I continue with the role-playing game, my hope is, I don't really have a time frame associated with the release, but my hope is at least to do beta testing of the role-playing game by the end of this year, if not earlier. And my hope is, because we have a number of listeners the world over, that maybe the listeners would be interested in doing some of this beta testing. And what that would probably involve is me sending physical copies of the rules to you. But I'll talk a little bit more about that probably in a few months' time when I have that more settled down. The rules as they are now, very much as I described, obviously there's this kind of mythology, history, and a wide variety of other elements that are put into place. But the rules are very much kind of abstract rule system now, very little battling. In fact, one of the feedbacks that I've gotten from readers is that the threat of violence and the threat of the unknown is really a central theme through the book, but there are no machine gunning scenes or anything like that. It's all very thematic and potential of violence, and I think that's a theme that is carried through in the role-playing game as well. That basically, while you can get access to weapons and you can go out and do damage and kill kill people if you want to, really the far greater strategy is actually more to do with survival than it is to do with actual violence. So that's Field of Chaos, all one word, .com. For the latest information, I have a couple of podcast episodes recorded, and my anticipation is actually to do a kind of leisurely field of chaos podcast, because a number of the folks in the book are actually real people. And this is one of the curious things about writing a book like Field of Chaos, is that, although I've changed a lot of the names and there are like censored photos through the book and these kind of things, a number of the real people that appear in the book are still willing or actually would like to talk about it more. So it's one of these curious things that there may actually be actual folk from the book that appear in the Field of Chaos podcast going into the future, but I'm probably providing too much editorialization. Go out there if you have the money. It seems relatively cheap by general electronic book standards, but it's been an absolute pleasure to get this out there. It's something I've been sitting on for, like I say, 17 years now, and it has a wide variety of quite curious themes that will probably explain themselves more in a role playing game context. But if you want to get up on the ideas early on, fieldofchaos.com, and it should be appearing in stores in the US in about 5 weeks' time. And my plan is to do like some kind of formal launch and maybe even, you know, a few actual releases at various bookstores and various locations. And then it will go international. So for folks listening outside the US, you will also be able to get it, obviously, online, but also through bookstores. And I think the time frame associated with that is probably another 4 to 6 weeks on after that. But it's been a really interesting process. I can see a lot of folk that do both role-playing and also fantasy and sci-fi writing and all this kind of stuff, using these kind of online publishing as a means. And obviously with Goblins in the Streets, there are folks that are already doing it. But my interest is really to do more long-form work in terms of Field of Chaos isn't actually that long. It's not a huge number of words. And my intention in doing it like that was just that people could read it in an afternoon quite comfortably. But I think the role-playing game aspect of it will be considerably longer and considerably more detailed, and I'm really looking forward to getting that out both in an electronic and paper form, although I suspect increasingly the paper form is really for eccentric old bibliophiles such as myself. Anyway, that's Field of Chaos, Jonathan.
Tom, I actually have two questions for you about Field of Chaos.
Certainly.
And you may not have the answers for them, but you had mentioned that people can get it now as a paperback, but also as an ebook.
Mm-hmm.
What e-readers is it compatible with? Is it all of them?
So,
what kind of format is it in? You know, like that kind of stuff.
So it's in the highly prized format of PDF.
Okay.
Which means that basically it should be compatible with absolutely everything. And my understanding is that the PDF, because I have tried to do like internal word searches and stuff, there's some protection. I don't have any control over the PDF. It's provided by Lulu.
Mm-hmm.
But my understanding is that it has some extraneous protection features in it. I'm not sure how easy those would be to get around. But obviously, my view is to sell it at such a cheap price is a way of kind of circumventing people wanting to pirate it anyway. So it's available as PDF, in answer to your question.
Okay, that's good. Because I know there's all these different formats. There's like EPUB and Mobi, and then Kindle has its own Kindle format and blah, blah, blah.
My suspicion is that it will be released in a wide variety of electronic formats, and I understand the way Lulu does it is, for example, it will be on Google Books, and I don't know what the Google Books format is, but it will basically they'll tune it to whatever format is available.
Okay. And then you mentioned it's going to be showing up in bookstores. Do you happen to know, like, what bookstores or where it'll be showing up, like, what states or, like, any of that kind of stuff?
My understanding... I'm sorry, there's an airport going on.
Okay. You okay?
Yeah. Just inhaled a little water. My bad for sitting on it while talking.
That's okay.
My understanding is that the two that it listed was with Borders and Barnes & Noble in the US, and I think it will also be available on order, which means that if folks don't see it, in fact, when it gets out into bookstores, this is also another interesting point, because if people actually go into their bookstores and order copies, it creates a different kind of like internal buzz through whatever systems they're using. So my sense is that it probably won't be appearing on shelves in every Borders and Barnes & Noble coast to coast, but it will be appearing in some Borders and Barnes & Nobles, and in the ones that it doesn't appear in, you can go in and say, I'd like a copy of Field of Chaos, and they will be able to order you one. Now, depending on the early sales, the electronic sales and various other things, it will also affect how it's represented in stores. But I think you should also be able to order it in independent bookstores and a wide variety of other places too. It's just through various infrastructure networks, but they did mention Borders and Barnes & Noble by name.
So for people who might happen to live in New England, could go to a local Borders, and if they don't see it on the shelf, they could have someone at like an info desk kiosk or whatever just place an order. That would probably be even more helpful than just getting it off the shelf, because it would show like proof of demand for it. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's very good to know. So anyone who's interested, I got to say, Tom sent me a copy, and I'm actually working my way through it. I've been working my way through it for a while, which I do have to apologize. So much I have to read for work. It's absurd. But I'm working my way through it, and it's a gripping tale. So I really do highly recommend picking it up. It's worth thumbing through. It's a great price right now online, even at full price. Tom, I got to say, I feel like you're giving it away. The list price is $4.99, I think, for the PDF, and it's like $12 maybe for the paperback. And I mean, that's not bad at all. See, other things going to Borders, whatever books are, they're not cheap.
No, they're not. I mean, my anticipation was basically to price it as low as possible, and certainly I'm going to be doing some academic publication in the near future through similar methods. Mm-hmm. And I really think the Lulu, I mean, I went through Lulu and also CreateSpace. CreateSpace was considerably cheaper, but the quality just wasn't there. And Lulu has the price almost right, the quality right on, and basically that's why I'm going through Lulu versus CreateSpace. But I've been really impressed with what they've done to date, and also the tuning of the prices that I've been able to do. I couldn't get it any cheaper in the paperback form than what they offered. So what I've done is taken a considerable discount, I think 20% currently, just so folks can actually buy it online for under $10, which was my original remit. But even, yeah, as you say, being able to pick it up in stores in a physical form for 13, whatever it is, 14-odd bucks is, you know, it's pretty reasonable too. And I think for folks who are listening in who are interested in getting their work out there, I've really got to recommend Lulu just as a means of getting stuff out. And certainly, although I'm yet to see the stuff hit the stores, and as soon as it hits the stores, I'm going to ramp up publicity associated with it as well in terms of getting copies out to, like, national book reviewers and things like that. But as it is now, it's kind of an internal word of mouth. It's been posted on various mailing lists, and I've got a lot of traffic from various folk. It's currently kind of for folks in the know release before it hits the stores. So if folks listening in, if you're interested, like Jonathan says, it's not a huge amount of money. It is a bit of a page turner. I'm always interested in receiving correspondence. In fact, that's actually the best thing about getting it out there, is having a wide variety of folk who, some of whom I know, some of whom I don't know, get in contact with me and just ask a wide variety of quite curious questions. So that's why I've done it.
Well, what I would be interested in is for those of you who do pick up a copy of it, whether you get it now on, you know, an e-version, or if you get a paperback version, or you get it in the stores, send in email us a picture of yourselves with the book, reading the book, do something, you know, interesting or whatever. And we'll start putting pictures up on Facebook. I'm sure Tom would love to have it on his Field of Chaos Facebook page, and, you know, do little testimonials or something. It'd be interesting to see inventive ways to help further the word.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Jonathan. So, it's been a good show. It's been good to be back, Jonathan. I've really missed talking to you for the past few weeks. I tried to hook up podcasting when I was staying in a hotel in Reno, and the bandwidth just wasn't there for Skype, unfortunately. But obviously you've been busy as well with TotalCon and other things. But, you know, we're going to get back into the rhythm of things. We're going to try continuing this weekly recording. And I know, in particular, I want to talk to Henry Hyde, so I may set up a Skype call with Henry and hopefully get you on. But, yeah, just try and track him. And similarly, I also want to talk with Neil Shook of the Meeples and Miniatures podcast. My understanding is in a couple of months' time, we will have Jeff Carroll of Podhammer here in Las Vegas, together with the fellow they call Kent Fury, although that isn't his real name. And they're actually part of the group of people that no longer play Warhammer. I mean, how would you feel about having a podcast devoted to Warhammer and then deciding you didn't want to play it anymore? Anyway, so, yeah, Jeff will be in town, and I'm certainly going to meet up with him and record him, hopefully in a somewhat coherent state, although my understanding is that I need to get him as soon as he leaves the airport in order to maximize that potential. And, yeah, I think there are going to be a number of quite interesting guests, and obviously we're going to be doing some hostage exchange with the What Would Pam Do podcast going into the future because they like my accent in particular.
Yes, they do.
They all sound the same to me, but I mean, hey. Anyway, Jonathan, it's been a pleasure as always this evening. How could folks get in contact with us?
Well, we have a lot of different ways, of course. Our Facebook page, you go to Facebook, just look up CWF Gamecast. You can get in touch with us that way. Head over to our blog, which is wargamingforums.com. We have our email address, which is, I forgot what our email address is, cwfgamecast@wargamingforums.com. And then we have our Twitter feed, and there's like a gazillion things. But basically, best way, try Facebook and head over to our blog. It has all sorts of different things on there to get in touch with either one of us. So you can do that, and hopefully you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back again next week when we have another show for you to listen to. We'll have more stuff to talk about. More gaming and all sorts of goodness.
In a world with 10,000 music podcasts, all you need is a podcast not from this world.
Proto!
Yes, Captain?
Why is there a tentacle on my control board?
Coming at you live from somewhere just outside the Earth's atmosphere, it's High Orbit. With Matthew Eagle.
Proto, you'd better be making the world's biggest sushi bar, or we're in a world of trouble right now.
Get on board at highorbitpodcast.com.
The CWF Gamecast is proudly sponsored by 127games.com, home of the cheapest Axis and Allies miniatures. Find them at 12-7-games.com. Look for the CWF Gamecast online at www.wargamingforums.com. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. You can find me on Xbox Live as CWF Gamecast. You can find out more about this episode by reading the show notes on our blog. Thank you for listening, and keep on gaming.